Good morning.
Good morning.
Marjorie, thank you again for inviting me back. I also take the opportunity to let you know my current Wednesday morning class at Beth Emmet is now reaching the end. This is the last of the 6-week series on mental health. We have a lighter topic coming in January. The topic is Game of Thrones, the Persia edition. And we'll be talking about some of the Persian kings and their interaction with the Jews. So we'll be talking about, of course, Esther and Ahasuerus from Purim, but also King Cyrus, King Darius, their interactions with Daniel. There's quite a bit to talk about. So that'll be a 4-week series in January, God willing. And a very funny thing happened this morning. I'm based in a boys' high school, so I went into the teacher's lounge to make copies, and there was a teacher who's Shaliach. He comes from Israel to teach, and one of his jobs is to teach Hebrew, and he was trying to figure out how to grade a particular question on an exam. And the word in Hebrew was achyanit. Anyone know what achyanit?
Yeah, please.
Right. So the student niece, but the student had written on the test, and to translate Afghani, had written nephew parentheses female. And the teacher was trying to figure out how to grade what that meant. So I told my niece that the student didn't know how to spell niece. First of all, it just happened right before I came over here, but also because the topic that we have doesn't really allow much for jokes. I have to, at some point, figure out a way to get it in. Our topic, as I usually put it on the sheets, is definition of life. But you all know what we're talking about, and it came about as a topic for us to discuss. Because of a case that probably most, if not everyone here, is aware of in the Jewish community locally. The case of a young man, 25 years old, who had an asthma attack and was not found and helped until he had been deprived of oxygen long enough that it went to coma, the brain is no longer functioning at a detectable level, and then the debate of the hospital wanting to take him off of life support and the family saying, well, we don't believe that he's considered dead from a Jewish perspective. And it's a horrible case. And unfortunately, these things happen, whether you're talking about someone younger, whether you're talking about someone older. The issues come up on a regular basis. And I've written a couple of columns about this in the weekly email that I send out from my baby garage. And Marjorie suggested that it might be a good topic to discuss here. So, yeah, it's a hard topic. It's a sensitive topic. It comes up. It shocked me to find out that people here have had this, debated issue within their own families. And so I'm going to try to spend our time this morning trying to unpack the issue and explain where the different groups within Judaism are coming from on this, where the doctors are coming from on this. What is the basis for the different points of view here? And if we have time at the end, maybe a little bit about the relevant ethical issue of, let's say I, as a Jew, believe one standard, but the broader non-Jewish community has another standard. Is it right for me to demand that my relative, be kept on life support following my standard when, to everybody else, this person has already passed away? So, it's a lot to cover, but we'll see what we can do. We have to start with a little bit of history, and the history of defining life and defining death. So in order to do that, we have to go back to grade 5, grade 6, grade 7 biology. How do you define something as alive? What makes something alive?
Breathing.
Oh my, all those anaerobic bacteria are apparently dead, right?
Has cells.
Has cells? Well, that's kind of what?
Thinking.
Oh boy. Well, that all the students in that high school. They won't start thinking until they're 20-something.
Reproduction.
Sorry? Reproduce, right? That's one of those. See, when I was in school, they taught us that there are 7 properties of living beings. Now, those numbers change over time, right? In the same way that there were 9 planets, and then there were 8 planets, and now there are 9 planets again, but we don't know exactly where the 9th one is. So, or continents, right? Continents is another one. Oceans is another one. I'll never forget when my oldest got into kindergarten, and the teacher was upset that he had made a mistake. He didn't know how many oceans there were. And she proceeded to tell me about, I think it was the Antarctic Ocean. I never learned about the Antarctic Ocean. I don't know what she was talking about. I would have done kindergarten also. The truth of the matter is that some of these things do change, and so I wouldn't take the standard of 7 properties of light all that seriously. But I gave you on the sheet a quick digest off of the Khan Academy website. It's a good educational website. They do a nice job. Organization. Living things are highly organized. Alright, some of that anyway. No, I'll explain what that means. And all living organisms, see, I thought there was no humor in this topic. What is that? And all living organisms are made up of 1 or more cells, which are considered the fundamental units of life. So, in other words, what that means is a living being has parts which all have to function together to keep the thing running. And even if it is a single cell, the cell itself has parts within it. That's going to be really important as we go forward, this issue of organization. Metabolism. Life depends on an enormous number of interlocking chemical reactions that make it possible for organisms to do work. They have to use energy. You have to be able to digest and produce energy. Fine, that's the second one, is metabolism. Homeostasis. Living organisms regulate their internal environment to maintain the relatively narrow range of conditions needed for cell function, right? To maintain balance among the body's systems. Clearly, there's overlap between things like organization and homeostasis. These are just manifestations of the same process. But let's say your body temperature needs to be kept relatively close to 98.6, 37, depending on which side of the border you come from. Growth. Living organisms undergo regulated growth. Regulated being very important, right? When you deal with cancer cells, are they considered to be alive in their own right because it's unregulated growth? Reproduction. Living organisms can reproduce themselves to create new organisms. Response. Living organisms show irritability, right, especially before their morning coffee, meaning they respond to stimuli or changes in their environment. And then finally, evolution. They can undergo evolution, meaning the genetic makeup of a population may change over time. It's very funny to see that as a property of a living being. You have to be able to change. You have to be able to adapt in order to be considered alive. I find that fascinating. But those are 7 key factors. However, it's really important to recognize, and this is going to matter when we talk about brain death, that these are not scientific definitions. How do we get to these 7 factors? How do you come up with these 7 factors? Observation. Right? Observation. You're looking around and you're trying to come up with terms that fit our preconceived notion of what is and is not alive. I walk in thinking that a desk is not alive, that a person is alive, that a plant, let's say, is alive, and based on that, I'm going to go looking for what makes this one side of it and what makes that the other side of it. But it's not a scientific definition. It's simply a matter of coming up with what it is about this creature that convinces me that this is within the rubric of living things. And I think that's really important, because the same thing is going to be true when it comes to defining death. Which is to say, it's not about a scientific definition. It's about what best describes a definition we have already intuited somehow, such that this is death and this is life. And we'll see, we'll unpack that a little more as we go along. On a practical level, when you talk about a specific organism and defining a specific organism as living or dead, it really comes down to 3 systems. There are 3 systems within the body that matter across the board in all cultures, I think, in terms of defining a particular organism as alive, or the new human being, I should say, as alive or dead. What systems within the body are critical to this definition?
Heart.
Heart, right, for sure. Cardiac.
Lungs.
Right? Lungs. Breathing. The pulmonary system. And the brain. Neurological. Cardiac, pulmonary, neurological. Those are the three systems within the body that pretty much everybody works with. The cardiac meaning heart delivery of blood, pulmonary meaning the lungs processing of oxygen, and then neurological, really the nervous system, the brain, the spine, the nerves that are controlled. Now, for most of human history, you didn't need to care about which one of these defined a person as being alive or dead, because they all collapsed in fairly short order at the end of life. The heart is technically an autonomous muscle. The heart can keep on beating without the brain telling it that it needs to beat. However, it needs regulation of the pressure inside of the blood vessels. And that's going to happen as a result of the hypothalamus, the brainstem, sending signals. So the brain is involved in regulating it, even if the heart can beat on its own. So if you had somebody whose brain was no longer sending signals, the heart might beat for a little while, but not very long. The lungs need regulation from the respiratory control center within the brain. If the brain isn't functioning, the lungs are going to stop functioning. In the event that the lungs stop, they stop taking in oxygen, it's only a couple of minutes before the brain's going to stop. Right? In the event that the heart stops beating, blood isn't circulating, oxygen doesn't get to the different parts of the body, they're all interconnected, they all, to one extent or another, rely upon each other, and therefore, no one needed to debate at what point a person's life is considered to be over, because they basically collapsed at roughly the same time, and there wasn't really anything we could do about it. When one stopped, there wasn't, we had some form of resuscitation, cardiopulmonary resuscitation in a rudimentary form a while back, but that's basically what we had. There wasn't any means of reversing this. But today, of course, things have changed. Medical progress enables us to actually replace some of these functions. The brain can stop sending messages, but we can still keep breathing and circulation going with machines and medication. The lungs can stop. We can replace them with a ventilator. Right? Now, what do? You have the means of keeping some of these systems going, and even really, basically you can replace the heart and the lungs with a heart-lung machine. And then the brain isn't doing anything, but it doesn't need to if all you care about is the heart and the lungs. And so now we have a question. When is somebody alive, and when is someone no longer alive? So let me ask you a question. Leaving aside religion for a moment, generally, within human society, who should decide the question of which of these systems, one of them, two of them, three of them, whatever, who should make the decision of how to define death? Sorry, I heard a few different answers.
Medical
people. Let the doctors decide. Why the doctors?
Well, they know more than anybody else.
What do they know more about? See, this is a really interesting question. You could take the view that the decision is fundamentally a medical decision, and there's a certain intuitive logic to it, because after all, they're the ones who are treating the patient. They know how the systems work. But does it make a whole lot of sense for them to make this decision in terms of who's considered to be alive? They can apply your definition. But why should they make your definition? It's a really interesting question.
I think an ethical committee is important because there are multiple factors that go into this. Most recently, one of the Scientific American editions, they talked about consciousness and how to measure it, and they now have machines that can measure a person in a coma but has some level of consciousness. So one has a thing, this is not common, but it is around. So these are ethical questions and slash religious questions, more than just medical.
Right. So you make the point that this is really an ethical question. And you require experts in ethics to provide an answer. She points out, it's true, studies have been done now regarding people in coma. It's really important to distinguish the medical terms from each other. Coma and brain death are not synonymous. But what's been determined is people who have been identified as being in a persistent vegetative state, where we're told they're not coming out of it and that they're not even aware, some 20% of cases have been discovered that they actually are aware of what's going on around them. The classic test, I think we've done at Western actually, is they use an fMRI to determine that they had a patient who was in a persistent vegetative state, unresponsive and so on, and they asked the patient to imagine playing tennis. And sections in the brain that are related to the activity of moving their arm lit up. And then they asked to imagine walking down the stairs. They even took somebody and had him watch a movie. Not watch, because he can't see it, he can only hear it. But respond to different sectors of the brain lit up. Now, this is not true for everybody in a persistent vegetative state. They said as many as 20% potentially have some kind of responsiveness to what's going on around them. So that raises the question, ethically, is that life? Now, how do you deal with somebody? Now, saying that it should be dealt with by ethicists, though, is kind of a fudge as an answer. Because what makes an ethicist any more able to answer this question than a doctor? What is an ethicist? Again, leaving religion out of it. What is an ethicist? A theoretician.
Moral values.
Maybe, but they can have their own moral values, right? You can tell you about Peter Singer? Right? Peter Singer is an ethicist who believes that animals should be preserved above human beings. He also has moral values. They may not be mine. But you have to know that you're playing a dangerous game when you authorize an ethicist to make your decisions. You have to know what the system is, where the ethics come from is the problem. So,
societal
So look at the ethicist potentially as a reflection of society, trained in society's values, and therefore able to apply them? Maybe. Yeah.
But would an ethicist decide if the quality of life could be assumed again, or what about the experience to the community and the country?
So the question really is, what drives the ethics that themselves inform the ethicist? And here you have to enter into other considerations. Maybe the government. Everybody groans when you say that. Everybody groans when you say the government. But ask yourself this question. Who is in a better position than the government to understand the many factors that are involved? Anybody? By the money you're going to spend. And we're kidding ourselves if we pretend that's not true. Right? So now you have to ask yourself, maybe the government is in the best position because they know what the resources are and they're responsible for the allocation. So maybe they should be the ones marketing it.
The question on the government is, in this case here in Toronto, 100 of you went to the court.
I'm not that there yet.
Okay, but that was in government saying yes or no.
Right, well, technically the legal system, which is a branch of the government, but agreed. Agreed. We haven't talked about that case. We might even get there. We'll see. Yeah?
I think it's a question of trust. So you're talking about each of these doctor, ethicists, government come with a different point of view, whether
yep.
it's money or morality or values or scientific reality. It's who do you trust?
Right.
Because each of these brings something else to the table, and you're saying no to one because you don't trust that they will bring the other two as well.
Right. So one way to look at this is that it's about trust, and trust that whoever's going to make this decision is not going to go based on self-interest, but is actually going to look at all the different aspects that are involved, and that is a very difficult thing to do. That is how we end up with ethics committees, because we look at it and say, let's get representation from from each body, put them on a committee, and have them hash this out. And that's it. That's one of the ways that society has come up with. But fundamentally, what I want to show you with this, before we get to the Jewish sources on it, is that there's nothing scientific and there is nothing even medical about choosing a particular definition of death, whether neurological, pulmonary, circulatory. Fundamentally, it's society getting together and saying, we need a definition. We're going to authorize someone who we believe is informed on the things that we care about to determine a definition. And then it's going to be the job of science and the doctors to declare when the definition has been met. Because that's where their expertise comes into play. Once society has said we've adopted the criteria for brain death, then the doctor can say, yes, this person is or this person is not. But that's the way that this plays out. That's the way that this works. Now, society's method is going to include the different factors we've outlined here. 1968, a team of experts come up with what has become known as the Harvard Criteria. And that's the source number 3 on your sheet. They set out rules and tests to determine what is commonly called brain death. The truth of the matter is that brain death is a misnomer. It doesn't actually mean brain death. It's not that every cell in the brain has ceased to function. It's not even that every part of the brain, every unit of the brain has ceased to function. Not all functions are necessarily gone. There may be brain waves on certain levels. Right? The term brain death is fundamentally a misnomer. The brain is not dead. Some like the term cessation of detectable neural function. That we are not able to tell that it is doing anything. Others like the term brain stem death. The brain stem being what communicates certain very basic functions to the rest of the body and organizes what the rest of the body is doing. That's another definition that's used. Take a look at source number 3, please. Here are the criteria. 1. Is the patient unreceptive and unresponsive with a total unawareness of externally applied and even painful stimuli? The patient isn't responding. Isn't aware of, not just not responding, but unreceptive. The patient is not receiving the signals that are being sent from the outside world. That's number 1. Number 2, if the patient has no spontaneous movements or breathing, as well as an absence of response to stimuli such as pain, touch, sound, or light. So not only is it not responsive, but the person is also not generating anything. There's no spontaneous activity. And if the patient has no reflexes, has fixed dilated pupils, lack, it should say, of eye movement, and lack of deep tendon reflexes. So not only is there no processing and no awareness, but even the reflexes that the brain would normally control are not active. In addition, there are tests. They have to do an electroencephalogram. The protocol may require that it be repeated 24 hours later. And the following must be present. Body temperature of at least 32 degrees Celsius. And absence of central nervous system depressants. What are they counting for with those last two items? Anyone in medicine? Okay, then I can just say whatever I want. What they're accounting for here is, number 1, hypothermia, right, in terms of body temperature. Because a person whose body temperature is lowered may not be dead, but it's going to look like it. Their systems aren't responding, but if you're able to warm them up, they actually could be able to function. So that's in terms of body temperature. And then central nervous system depressants, agents which could be keeping them from responding. However, when those are out of their system, they will respond. So you have to make sure to rule out other possibilities. That's the definition here that we're working with. And another key, which actually I don't see in the wording here, but I think it's understood, perhaps it should be stated, is that it should be permanent loss of these functions. And that's what we're getting at with the temperature and the CNS depressants and so on, is that this is permanent and that it is irreversible.
But you don't know if it's permanent until later.
Well, technically, you never know if something is permanent, right? I mean, you know, I can leave a rock on the table and tell it, I can tell you that it's unresponsiveness is not permanent. The truth of the matter is, once we get into the realm of empirical observation, you can't prove anything. So yes, if you're going to demand evidence of permanence, you will be there for a very long time. But opponents of this standard, which is the standard adopted in much of North America at this point, and even much of the world, but opponents argue that there are functions that are managed by the body and continue to be managed even after all of these criteria have been met. The body can fight infection without it being dictated from the brain. The body can heal wounds without it being dictated from the brain. Much of homeostasis can be taken care of. Children in this position, their bodies in many ways will continue to mature. There are stories every couple of years about pregnant women who are brain dead and then are kept going on life support. Call it life support. Some people will not call it life support, but you know what I mean. They're kept going by machines and they will carry children to term. And so the question becomes, what do you mean when you say they're dead? They're doing all the things that I would think of as defining someone as alive, going back to my criteria in the first place. They can create a child. I mean, they can't create. They're gestating the child. There are reflexes that continue to work. Not all reflexes are based in the brainstem, right? Some of the classic ones, like the knee, right? You hit the knee and the foot jerks up, right? Plantar flexion, right? The idea that you tickle the bottom of somebody's foot and their toes will curl. That's not dependent on the brain. And the result of it is that you can have somebody declared brain dead and their family can come in and look at them and say, what do you mean they're dead? They had a cut that's scabbing over now. If they're dead, why did that happen? To which proponents of brain death as a standard will say, because the fact that the body can do certain things doesn't mean the person is alive. But then you run into trouble because you're trying to define alive and people are using different definitions. So that's why this becomes such a difficult thing to deal with, and add in all the emotions that surround this kind of a moment in time, and then you're in big trouble. So from a Jewish perspective, how does this get addressed? So there are three central sources that we need to unpack here. The first source, all these resources are from the Talmud, which means you're talking about material that's a couple of thousand years old. The first one is source number 4. Dealing with the case of a building collapsing on Yom Kippur or on Shabbat, well, normally we would not be allowed to dig through rubble on Shabbat. We're not be allowed to dig through that on Yom Kippur. However, if there's somebody buried underneath, then of course you do. Right? That's the rule. That's what you're supposed to do. But what happens if you're digging through the rubble, you find the person that you believe to be buried underneath, and you realize they're no longer alive? Well, at that point, you wait until Shabbos is over. Right? There's nothing to do. You can't save them. They're dead. But how do you know if they're dead or not? Right? You start digging. You arrive at the legs. And you work your way up, and you get to their chest, and there's no heartbeat. Do you stop? Or do you say, well, maybe they're breathing? And you therefore keep on going. You started at the head. You found the head first. They're not breathing. You put your hand by their neck, you don't feel a pulse. Do you keep on going to the heart, though, to detect whether there is a heartbeat? So that's the question the Talmud is wrestling with in source number 4. I bring a piece of a longer debate. Rav Papa, the sage in this particular passage, Rav Papa, I believe, lived somewhere around the 3rd century. No, actually 4th century. It has to be 4th. Rav Papa said, there is debate as to whether checking the lower portions suffices. It's not clear whether it's enough to check the chest and see whether there's a heartbeat. There's a debate on that. But if you're starting from the upper portions, you started at the head, then once one has checked the nose, there is no further checking required. If they're not breathing, that's it. Now, there are two ways you can read this source. One way to read it is to say this supports the idea that the heartbeat is really what demonstrates life, which is why the he says, I'm sorry, there's one view that says that it's the heartbeat that we're supposed to learn about from here. However, the debate is, maybe the heart is beating, but I can't detect it, and therefore I should work my way up. That's one way to look at this, is that it's really about the circulatory system. If you take a look at source number 5, by Moshe Feinstein, writing at this point in the 1970s, said, heartbeat, many poskim means authorities in Jewish law. You know what I did? Huh, that's funny. I forgot. I was going to write a translation of his note, and I didn't. All I did was include my note on it. All right, that's just my note that you see there. That's not his writing. I apologize. But Rabbi Feinstein takes the position that what's going on here is that it's the heartbeat. The other way to read this, though, is that it's not about the heartbeat. How else could you read source number 4? Number 4. How else can you read number 4? Number 5 is just my note. The number 4.
Breathing.
Breathing, right? The other way to read it is that breathing is what matters. Even according to the view that says that we stop when you can't detect the heartbeat, that's only because, you know, if there's no heartbeat, there also isn't any breathing in the days of Rapapa, right? Going back 1600 years, that's the way the world worked. But it could be really about breathing. So this source gives me a possible argument for heart, and gives me a possible argument for lungs. Doesn't mention brain. Why not? How are you going to detect any brain function? That's meaningless. What are you going to do on the site of the ruin in the 4th century?
Right.
Well, we'll just hook up the EEG and see what happens. Obviously not. So you're working with heart, you're working with breathing. However, there are sources that address the issue of brain function. Flip the page, please, to source number 6. This is a Mishnah. We're now going back further in Jewish history. Now we're at the 2,000-year mark, roughly. And this is dealing with animals and the issue of tum'ah. Tum'ah is a state of ritual disqualification in which something has passed away, and then someone comes in contact with it, that person is now tameh and is no longer able to, let's say, walk into the Beit HaMikdash, into the temple, until they've been purified, until they've eliminated the status of being tameh. So the question is, at what stage does a human, or an animal for that matter, communicate tum'ah? And that's source number 6. Humans, as well as domestic and wild animals, do not communicate tum'ah until their lives depart. If their heads are cut off, then they communicate tum'ah, even if they still spasm. As in the case of a spasmodic tail of a lizard, the word in the original in the Mishnah is mifarkesed. What they're trying to tell you is that movement doesn't necessarily define life. If the head is cut off, the creature is dead. Now, inevitably, when you talk about this, someone somewhere brings up the case of Mike the Headless Chicken.
Yes.
You've all heard about Mike the Headless Chicken at a county fair. Okay, Mike the Headless Chicken happened. How it happened is a really good question. But fundamentally, the general rule is that if something doesn't have a head anymore, it is dead. And I don't care if the chicken can still run around. And I don't care if the lizard's tail is still twitching. That wasn't funny. The rule is that this creature is now tameh, this creature is dead for all intents and purposes. If you take a look at source number 7, you find Maimonides commenting on this Mishnah regarding the creature that has had the head cut off. He says this occurs in some types of creatures, this meaning spasmodic motion. It occurs in some types of creatures when the mobilizing force is not spread through all of the organs from a single foundation and source, but is scattered through the body. What's he talking about with this mobilizing force? No. Nerves. Because of a distributed nervous system, there could be nerves that will still be firing even if the head is no longer connected to the body. Right? That's what he's saying. It's a distributed nervous system. But in the 12th century, that's the description you're going to get. This mobilizing force. Okay. So based on this Mishnah in source number 6, and based on the explanation that Maimonides gives, Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman, who's alive and well, thank God, today in New York, argues that what we're saying here is that if movement is no longer integrated by a center in the brain, that means that the person is dead. Whether it's because the head has been cut off, or because the head is no longer sending signals for some other reason. That's already sufficient to define death. That introduces the possibility that we go back to our very first criterion for what life is, organization. And that you require that there be some kind of an organizing entity, that being the brain. And even if the heart retains some function, and even if there are living brain cells, if the brain is not running the movement of the body, and movement doesn't just mean movement, it's all the other things that the brain is responsible for, if the brain can't do that anymore, then the person is considered to be dead. Well, again, this is not straightforward. Right? It sounds like it could be. The first reason it's not straightforward is because now I have two conflicting sources. Right? You have a problem. You have what we call machlokas. Now you have a debate. Because my Mishnah that I, my Mishnah, my Talmud is in source number four, Rav Papa, is well aware of this Mishnah. The Mishnah precedes him by a couple of centuries, and he's an expert in Mishnah. He knows very well about this Mishnah, and yet he gave an answer regarding the guy who's in the rubble that either could be interpreted to mean heart or could be interpreted to mean breathing, but it wasn't about brain. He didn't even mention that. So, does that mean he disagreed? Does that mean that there are other voices who disagree within Jewish tradition? How do we resolve two conflicting sources? The other problem is that there is integrated activity that happens within the body that's not driven by the brain. You have something called the enteric nervous system, right? It governs your digestion, governs your stomach, your intestines. That's not driven by the brain. That's organized locally within the body. There is activity that is governed by the brain even after brainstem death. One of the problems that you run into here is the problem of the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is within the brain. And it will continue to send signals and regulate certain things even after brainstem death. There are articles and studies on it. So that makes this a lot more difficult. But we have a second source now that seems to argue that when the brain is no longer running the body's systems, that's when the person is now declared dead. And our third and last source, also from the Talmud, source number 8. They're talking about injuries which happen, which render a person dead. If the neck and most of its flesh are broken, the body communicates tum'ah, communicates impurity, is severing. It doesn't just mean broken in what we think of broken as in inside is broken, but everything's intact, roughly. What we mean is the severing of the neck and most of its flesh, that constitutes death. And the commentators to that say that means even if there is some kind of spasmodic motion. I brought you in source number 9, Maimonides, first from source number 6, where he talks about the farkase, the farkasin, this term of spasmodic movement, and he says the movement of avarim are parts of the body, after death. You follow what he just said? The fact that they're moving after death, in other words, as far as he's concerned, the being is dead, despite this spasmodic motion. And in number 10, you get his commentary on the laws of Shechita, ritual slaughter. And he says, if the neck and most of its flesh are broken, or its back is torn open, as is done to fish, or most of its trachea is severed, I apologize, this is gore you just ate, or its esophagus is punctured in a spot that would be suitable for Shechita, this animal is considered to be, quote, a living corpse. Uh-oh. What does that mean? Because it's a zombie. The term in the original Hebrew is nevela mechayim, which I think translates very smoothly to a living corpse. Nevela is a corpse. Chayim, living. Hence the translation. So now I actually have a problem. Right? Because now Maimonides is using a different term. In number 9, he was very clear. Spasmodic motion, the body is dead. right? And he applied that to the case in number 8, where the neck and most of its flesh are broken. But on the other hand, in number 10, he says, it's considered to be a living corpse. I don't even know what the phrase means. Right, I don't know. It sounds like what he's saying is it communicates impurity, like in a Be'elah, or you're not allowed to shaft it anymore. You can't engage in ritual slaughter because it's already a Be'elah. But it's still considered alive because of the movement that's going on. That's what it sounds like, yes?
Well, it seems to me that it almost sounds like a fresh corpse.
So one approach to this is to try to reread his phrase. But I have to say, that's hard. To reread that as a fresh corpse, he's using the term meikhayim from life. It sounds like he means it's actually alive, not it's already crossed over. That would be the normal read of those words. It's very hard to reread that.
Mimicking life?
Again, some do try to read it that way. I find it difficult. Yeah?
Well, time. I mean, the body is going to cease at one moment. I mean, it could be 5 minutes, could be whatever.
Yeah.
Is there time to wait? You wait.
So the question of whether there's time to wait is a really interesting one. Wait and see what happens. In the days of Maimonides, sure.
Yeah.
Wait a little bit, and they will stop functioning. Right? It is only a matter of moments. Right? In the days of the Talmud, absolutely. Today, it's a whole different ballgame. Because today, this person is going to get hooked up to a ventilator. And you are probably aware of the idea that even though Judaism may not require connecting someone to a ventilator in all circumstances, the idea of taking somebody off it, oh boy, that's something we generally don't do. But if the person is dead, of course we'll take them off the ventilator. So that's why we run into trouble here. Yes?
Why can't a person make their wishes known in writing the yearly
deficit? So this is a very important question. The question is, why can't a person make their wishes known in writing before they die? You know that Tessie case?
Yeah.
You heard that case?
Yeah.
Boy, that's a scary case. There was a patient who came into an ICU. No, that's right. It's an ER, I should say. It's an emergency room. And had a tattoo. It had a tattooed message on his chest saying, do not resuscitate. And the doctors didn't know what to do because they weren't sure if this was a poor decision made years ago that a person had then regretted it, but you know, they have a tattoo now, or whether this reflected a serious statement of intent by someone who wanted to make sure it would be available to the doctors at that time. And so in the end, they did not honor it. I believe I remember the article correctly, they did not honor it, yes. But going back to your question of a patient making their wishes known, from a secular standpoint, from a secular standpoint, there are two possibilities. Possibility number one is that their wishes are a brain death, in which case, very straightforward, because that's the standard that tends to be accepted in most municipalities in North America anyway. So that's what they're going to get. On the other hand, if their wishes are not governed by brain death, but rather by heart or lungs, then you run into law, right? Where the government in some area says, we have adopted this, not in Ontario, by the way. It is not law in Ontario to accept brain death. It's law to give it to the doctors to decide, and the doctors have adopted brain death. But if the law says we're not going to brain death, then your wishes won't matter because that's not what they're going to use. From a religious perspective, now let's flip it over to the other side, right? If Jewish law is going to say brain death doesn't count, then it doesn't matter what a person wishes; they're considered to be alive. I can't kill them because they want to be killed. That's a whole other discussion about medical assistance and dying. I think we actually had that discussion at some point. Did we talk about that at some point a couple years ago? I feel like we did. But the problem is, stating your wishes may not really change what's done. Now, I want to make one distinction very clear. There are a couple of hands I want to get to. But I want to make one distinction really clear here. On one side of what we've been talking about for the last 40 minutes or so, right, the last 44 minutes, which is the issue issue of determining when someone is dead. The other issue is determining what to do on behalf of somebody who is alive. Where everybody agrees they're alive. And the question is, should they be given a feeding tube or not? Should they be given a ventilator or not? Should CPR be done for them or not? What kind of CPR to do for them? All of those questions are a separate discussion, and there the issue of expressing your wishes will be most relevant. It's in terms of the definition of death where the wishes become less relevant, either because of the law, secularly, or because of the halakha, where the stakes are you killing somebody or not? That's where things change. But in terms of the issue of what do I do with somebody who is alive and just has said, I want this done or I don't want that done, that's a whole separate discussion. Yes? What's the sense of putting it in writing? Because of the discussion about what to do for somebody who's alive.
Yeah, but I have this in my will.
But not resuscitate again. That's a separation. That's regarding how we take care of somebody who is alive. That's not about determining the criteria for brain. That's a different discussion, yeah.
Maybe we should look at what happens after. I mean, keeping somebody alive is one thing. What will their future life be, I think?
Ah, that's a very good question. Okay, one of the big questions that comes up in this conversation is this. What are you keeping them alive for? Right? Especially if you are able to mimic what's going on. If you are able to keep the heart beating because you have a machine doing it, and you're able to keep the lungs going because they're doing it, and the body is going to just deteriorate in other systems. But fundamentally, they're not coming back out of this. It is, as far as we know, irreversible. Whatever permanent means, we can't reverse this state, and we've never seen it reversed. So in a case like that, the argument on one side is, what are you doing? They're not living. They're just there, productive machines. The argument on the other side is that if you believe someone is alive, it doesn't really matter when they're ever going to come out of it. They're alive right now. Right? Because the same argument has been used by certain societies over time to say, this person isn't really functioning. And therefore, we don't really need them within society. And therefore, we can just do away with them. And the argument goes, by what right do you say of somebody who I think is alive that their life is not worth living? That's the argument on the other side, is even if they never come out of this, they're alive right now. Yeah.
What if you have made your wishes names? Death is a fact of life, and I do not want resuscitation.
Again, this isn't about resuscitation as a question. This is a separation.
There's no cause.
Again, this isn't about wrong measure. This isn't about that. I want to make sure that this is clear. So everyone who has their hands up, just hang on for a second, please. I want to make sure this is crystal clear. The issue we are talking about is not the issue of heroic measures, is not the issue of CPR, is not the issue of resuscitation, is not the issue of artificial life, and none of that is part of this conversation. That's a separate, very important conversation about one's wishes and whether to keep on treating or keep on trying to extend a person's life of someone who is alive. What we're talking about now is someone who is beyond that point. It doesn't matter how many antibiotics you give them. It doesn't matter how many times you press their chest. Their heart is not going to start beating on its own. Their lungs are not going to start working on its own. And the brain is not going to start sending signals on its own. Right? This isn't about any of that. This is about the question of, can we bury this person or are they considered alive? And it isn't about what their wishes are. It becomes about law. And for those who are living, it will become about what the halakha has to say. Yeah?
Rabbi, you mentioned about the Jewish Christian who's gone on at the moment. Do you recall the Sunnyvale case?
The Rizzoli case, sure.
The first case I heard, and then went on for 7 years.
Years.
Months.
Not only that, it got better.
It did?
It got better.
The final story.
Okay. This is the Rizzoli. Sully case. The Sully case was not a brain death case. It's very important to know that. This is 2013. I'm reading an immigrant. I've lived here for quite some time. There was a mess that happened during a surgery, and the patient went into what was thought to be a permanent vegetative state. Not brain death, but a permanent vegetative state. Sunnybrook wanted to disconnect. The family said, absolutely not, we are religious Muslims, no way. It went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada because Sunnybrook made a mistake. Now, whether it was a mistake or whether it was just a strategy, we'll, leave that to the lawyers to discuss. But they made the argument that withdrawing care is also an act of medical care, and therefore the doctors get to decide. Instead of what they should have done, which was to go to the consent and capacity committee and make their case to the ethicists there that this patient is no longer alive, not coming out, whatever case they want to make, they argued they have the legal right to withdraw care. It was a gambit where they thought if we win, then in the future we can always make a decision about withdrawing care. And the Supreme Court of Canada did not agree with their argument. They lost. And Rasuli, about, 6 months to a year later, actually came back to some level of consciousness. Yeah. He's alive. He's alive today. So, not being part of his family, I'm not entirely sure. It's been about a year since I looked at the material on it, so I don't know anything updated beyond that. But look around online. You can find stuff about the Rasuli case. It was in all the headlines at the time. All right, I want to make sure to get to a couple of points here. So I'm going to ask you to hold the questions on this right now. But again, very important to recognize, this is not a discussion about DNRs. This is not a discussion about maintaining somebody, by artificial or heroic measures. That's not what this is about. What this is about is the question of at what point is this person no longer considered to be alive. So we have three different Talmudic sources. One of which sounds like it's either breathing that matters or the heart that matters. One of which sounds like it's talking about the integrated function of the body as led by the brain. And one that also seems to be talking about the brain, right? Until I get to Maimonides, who throws in this weird phrase of a living corpse, and I don't know what that phrase means. So contemporary authorities in Jewish law have tried different ways to explain these sources. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was probably the leading authority in Jewish law in North America in the latter half of the 20th century, he passed away in 1986. So for most of his life, he rejected brain death. However, his grandson, Rabbi Moshe David Kendler is a doctor, biologist, researcher, as well as an extremely accomplished rabbi and authority in Jewish law. He was actually also my biology professor in my first year at university. And Rabbi Kendler believes that Rabbi Feinstein changed his mind towards the end of his life, and he argues that you could read his latter response on the topic, his later response on the topic, to argue that, in fact, Rabbi Feinstein accepted brain death, and Rabbi Kendler argues for acceptance of the Harvard criteria as halacha. Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, another major name in North America towards the end of the 20th century, said this can't be resolved. He says, you can't. You have sources that compete. We don't know which one is right. Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. He said you can't resolve it, and therefore his students view it as something that is in doubt, and since it's a life or death matter, they will demand cessation of brain function as well as cessation of heart and lung function in order to determine that somebody is dead. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach in Israel initially accepted brain death as a possibility, but then when he starts to learn more about the difference between brain death and brain stem death, started to get more antsy about this and retracted it. But some Israeli authorities have now come to accept brain death, notably Rabbi Zalman of Tanya Goldberg, a leading authority in Jewish law in Israel today. And what you find is, certainly within Orthodox circles, and I can't speak for beyond that authoritatively, but within Orthodox circles, you have a significant camp in Israel that accepts brain death, and you have a significant camp in Israel that says no. In North America, the majority are with heart and lungs. with Rabbi Kettler leading a vocal school that says brain death is sufficient. That's really the state of things today. Remember, you're dealing with a situation in which there is no winner. Saying, I'm going to be lenient on behalf of the patient, and therefore say, we're going to keep the patient going, means that you are draining society and potentially taking resources that can be used for other patients. Saying I'm going to try to protect society and the prospective next patient means that I'm harming the patient on the table if I believe that this patient is in fact still alive. And keep in mind that halakha, the system of Jewish law, is naturally conservative, right? Small c. Halakha doesn't like taking risks, and particularly in matters of life and death. And I don't know is considered to be a legitimate response within Jewish law. And so what you end up with is controversy, and different consensus are building in different groups. And ultimately, I suspect over the next generation, you'll end up with a definitive response just because one group is going to win over the other. I don't think this is going to endure more than another couple of decades. But in the interim, it's very much a controversy without clear resolution. But that's at least where this is coming from. And the points that I want to make sure that people come away with out of this are that this is not an issue of some ancient debate about where the soul lives within the body. That's not what this is about. This is also not about doctors are evil and rabbis are good, and rabbis are going to save you from the evil doctors. Doctors go into medicine in order to help people and in order to extend life and in order to extend health. They're not, this is hard because, you think, well, isn't that the most obvious statement under the sun? But when people get into this situation, it becomes the doctors want to pull the plug and I think that, that they're terrible. It's nonsense. That's not the nature of medicine. They wouldn't have gone to medical school in order to do that. It's important to recognize that on both sides, these are well-meaning people who are doing their best with the knowledge that they have to resolve that which fundamentally can't be resolved, in the sense that it's ultimately society's definition. Whether it's a Jewish society that says the Torah is my source and then has to wrestle with the competing sources within Torah, or whether it's a secular society that has to wrestle with the competing ethics that are involved. And all sorts of complications we didn't go into. The secular complications of how you come up with a decision other than to know the economics of it. But it's much more complicated than that, right? If you have a society which says everyone at a certain point, permanent, persistent vegetative state, brain death, whatever it is, we no longer have them, right? We say simply, this is it, it's over. Then you run the risk that society will no longer invest in the types of treatment which could actually make a difference. Because, we decided they're dead, right? It's like communities that decided we're not dealing with homelessness anymore. We're just going to say, no, we'll put them in jail, or we'll create a halfway solution and tell them this is where you have to go, and now there are no homeless people anymore. But that's the equivalent, right? That's what you run the risk of. There are all sorts of calculations on the ethical side for society that we didn't even go into. But the bottom line has to be, a respect for this different sides that are trying to deal with this, and ultimately to work on trying to preserve life in every way that we can going forward. I'm going to stick around for a few minutes to discuss more. I know there were a lot of comments that people still wanted to make, but I hope that things are a little more clear than they were an hour ago. Thank you very much.